Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Ani DeFranco. She has a new memoir out called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. Taylor Milliner speaks with author Carson Vaughn about Zoo Nebraska, The Dismantling of an American Dream, a book about rural Nebraska, population 81, with many of the town's main structures having been abandoned. It became home to a primate center, then a zoo, then small town politics leading to the demise of it all. We're going to start with culinary arts, and no stranger to KVC Arts or PBS. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
We are joined by Stephen Reichlin, PBS cooking show host, author of Project Smoke, Project Fire, and his new book, The Brisket Chronicles, How to Barbecue, Braise, Smoke, and Cure the World's Most Epic Cut of Meat. Thank you for speaking with us today, Stephen.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, and I'm always doing well as I go through your recipe books and watch your shows and learn a little more about how to make something that I can eat and not throw away. So I'm happy about that. Oh, by the way, a friend of yours, Elizabeth Carmel, asked me to give you an over-the-air hug, so there you have it.
Okay, great. Yeah, I know she's doing the radio media tour today, too.
Yes, yes. Now, Stephen, the last time we spoke was for your book, Project Smoke, where I learned that I could smoke meats very well in my apartment. But my first question for your book here is, what is a brisket?
So brisket is actually two muscles joined by a thick seam of fat that come from the chest of the steer. You could think about it as like the pectoralis in a human being. But unlike in a human being, the brisket is a load-bearing muscle. It's the muscle that enables a steer to stand up and move. So it's very well exercised. It's extremely flavorful.
Why is it so difficult for some of us to actually get a brisket, cook it, and make it servable to other people? What are we doing wrong?
Well, because brisket is loaded with a connective tissue called collagen, and that connective tissue is very tough. So you need to cook brisket for a long period of time over very low heat in order to make it tender.
We are learning. Thank you. What is the oldest brisket recipe that is known?
It's a very good question. It comes from an English cookbook that was published in 1769. So actually, it's older than our country.
Wow.
It's a very interesting recipe. It was braised in red wine, flavored with bacon, and also flavored with oysters. So you could sort of think of it as a brisket surf and turf.
That sounds great. Is that recipe still in use today?
I don't know that it has been made by anybody in a couple hundred years, but I do give the recipe in my book, The Brisket Chronicles. So undoubtedly there is going to be some curious soul out there who will try it.
I wish it were me right now, but it's not. Stephen, is your book, The Brisket Chronicles, is this written for the everyday pit enthusiast, or do we need more than basic knowledge to cook the recipes in it?
You know, it is a book that can be used by an absolute beginner. I walk you through the steps of smoking a brisket, barbecuing a brisket, 11 steps. It's a recipe that goes on for two or three pages just to make sure you don't make any mistakes. But there are also plenty of sophisticated recipes in the book for people who are a little more experienced who may want to try something more ambitious. Like, for example, a Korean direct grilled brisket that you can cook literally in 1 minute.
Whoa, really? Wow. Okay, I'm going to have to go back.
The secret is to freeze the meat, slice it paper thin on a meat slicer, and then direct grill it on a hibachi.
Ah, okay. I saw the part about freezing the meat, and okay, so I don't want to give too much away here.
Right.
Will you take just a moment to share with us where our listeners can find out about your new book, The Brisket Chronicles, and other culinary recipes?
Absolutely. So my website is barbecuebible.com. That's BarbecueBible.com. And the book is sold there. It's available online. It's available at bookstores everywhere. And if you want to follow me on Facebook, I'm at Stephen Reichlin. That's Stevenreichlin. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are S. Reichlin. And when you go to my website, barbecuebible.com, be sure and sign up for the Up and Smoke newsletter. It's a free weekly newsletter. It gives you lots of tips and secrets and recipes on brisket, barbecue, and beyond.
Okay. Wow. That is a bonanza right there for our audience. Thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome.
We have something going here where I have been to stores where I've seen cuts of meat, and I have absolutely no idea which one I should pick out. So how does one go about picking out the right cut of brisket first?
Well, first of all, there are two basic forms that brisket comes in. And one is the whole packer brisket. That's the both of those muscles I described. Weighs about 15 pounds. That's what the pros use at barbecue restaurants across Texas and Kansas City.
Okay.
Then there's the brisket flat, which is the leaner of the two muscles, a piece that could range in size from 3 to 6 pounds. And a brisket flat has the advantage of being it's leaner, it's quicker cooking, and it's what you typically find in a supermarket. The packer brisket, you tend to need to order ahead of time, but the brisket flat you find at your local supermarket.
Now, Stephen, if I'm cooking my first ever brisket, how would I do this so that I could gladly serve it to others? What does your book do to help me there?
Well, the first two recipes take you by the hand, step by step, in painstaking detail as to how to barbecue a brisket. So, for example, if you want to attempt a whole packer brisket, there are 11 steps. The book tells you how to trim the brisket, how to buy it, how to trim it, season it, what to use a smoking platform to keep the bottom moist, how to wrap it, how to tell when it's done, and how to rest it. The resting is a very important stage. You basically take your cooked brisket and place it in an insulated cooler for 1 to 2 hours. And this is a sometimes neglected step, but what happens is it relaxes the meat, it redistributes the juices, and it guarantees you a wonderful, succulent brisket.
Oh, this is some great news. I was going to ask about resting, but thank you so much.
That, yeah, of course, sure.
That helps me a lot. Now, Stephen, once the brisket is done, what are some of the recipes that can be put together as side dishes from your book?
Oh, man, where do I begin? Well, there's the four-bean brisket baked beans, which are the ultimate baked beans. There's this incredible crispy brisket salad with Southeast Asian seasonings, which is one of my favorite summertime salads. Imagine luscious cool pineapple, crunchy cucumber, fiery chilies, and shreds of deep-fried brisket. That's pretty awesome. For brisket, you'll find a pastrami hash. You'll find Kung Pao pastrami. You'll find brisket scones. There's even a brisket dessert in the book. It's a brisket chocolate chip cookie pioneered by a pitmaster in Austin, Texas.
Okay, that's just too much for me to think about right now. So I'm going to move on because it sounds so good. You know, I'm looking at one of my favorites in the book, Jake's Double Brisket Cheeseburgers. And I'm just so sad I can't just go out and get one right now. So
yeah, I know. That would be pretty awesome, wouldn't it?
It would be. I've never seen so many things. Brisket Yorkshire pudding. I couldn't even imagine that before reading your book.
Well, you know, traditional Yorkshire pudding is made with the drippings from a roast beef.
Right.
And, you know, anytime I hear drippings and I think about brisket, I think, you know, wow, well, why not add some chopped brisket and use brisket fat for the Yorkshire pudding? That would be amazing.
Well, Stephen, I really appreciate this book because I know there have been so many like myself who have gotten a brisket and almost decided to give up on ever cooking them again. So I have to thank you for this help. I think it's very timely.
The pleasure is entirely mine. Thank you.
You are welcome. Now, are you working on anything else at this time that we should look out for?
Well, I am. First of all, we just taped a new season of my Project Fire TV show. Project Fire is a show about barbecuing and grilling I do on PBS.
Yes.
And I'm actually working on a new book on grilling vegetables. So we're going from the beefiest, hunkiest, hardest core carnivore hunk of meat to grilling vegetables, but all part of my barbecue world.
That is a big world and much appreciated. Stephen, your book, The Brisket Chronicles, has taken a lot of the fear out of cooking a brisket well. And I just wanted to thank you again for that, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Stephen Reichlin. Again, barbecuebible.com for more. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with Ani DeFranco about her new memoir called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. First, Zoo, Nebraska, The Dismantling of American Dream. It's the story of a man who was set to work with primatologist Diane Fossey, but after her murder, moved to rural Nebraska with a chimpanzee, converted a trailer into a primate center, which then became a zoo attracting tourists for nearly 20 years. And then local politics began. Here's Taylor Milliner in conversation with author Carson Vaughn.
Out of all the topics that you have covered, why did you choose Zoo, Nebraska?
Well, after I started talking to more of the residents of Royal, Nebraska, and learning more about the history of this zoo, the more I started to recognize all of these very human, universal themes. And I just thought, if I could take a state that I was familiar with, like Nebraska, and tell a story that would resonate far outside of the borders of my home state, I would, you know, maybe be onto something here. And so what attracted me to Royal was both the familiarity I felt in this other small town in Nebraska, but also how novel and kind of strange it was to have a chimpanzee escape in this big zoo in a town of just 81 people.
Exactly. Zoo Nebraska is your very first book. Can you tell us how that experience is for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty wild ride so far. I mean, the research alone, it took me 10 years to write this book.
Wow.
And so, I mean, that's its own long history. And now that the book is out, it's been really encouraging to see not just my own home state covering the book and reacting to it, but to see people who are from, you know, small towns anywhere, or, you know, people in cities, just whoever, they're picking up on the aspects of the book that I were hoping they were going to pick up on. And that's been really refreshing, and I'm happy for it.
Right. So what took 10 years? What took the longest?
Well, I think the primary hurdle there, and the reason it took so long, is that the main character, Dick Haskin, who founded this zoo in Royal, Nebraska, he was traumatized by the events that ultimately went down there, and he refused to talk about the zoo. So for the first 8 years that I was trying to write this book, Dick was rejecting my interview requests. And
right.
so I stuck with him, you know.
You're loyal.
I would send him emails and give him phone calls, not enough to harass him, but enough to let him know that I wasn't giving up on this story.
Right.
And then 8 years in, I finally said, well, Dick, I've sold the book. I've talked to everybody around you and tried to fill in the gap you left, but this is kind of your last shot at representing yourself. And that's when he finally came around. And when he did, he gave me just wonderful material and was very candid. But he was a tough sell in the beginning.
I bet. So how do you feel now that the book is finished?
I feel both relieved and, you know, I'm still waiting to hear back from a few of the residents in Royal and a few characters in the book. But overall, you know, it's just 10 years is a long time to be working on a book, and I'm excited to keep moving forward and turning the page as a writer. But it feels really good to know that I put my heart and soul into this thing that started when I was 20 and I'm now 31.
Wow.
You know, it's nice to have a final finished product here.
I bet. Have you talked to Dick since the book has been finished?
I have, yeah. He was the one that I was on pins and needles about. You know, he told me all the darkest material in his life, and he trusted me to put it into a book responsibly. And so I sent him an advance copy of the book a few weeks before it was published, and he wrote me back and said, you know, Carson, as you suspected, this was a very painful book for me to read and difficult, but I think you did a great job with it. And then the last line of his email just said, I hope you write another book. I hope I'm not in the next one.
At least he felt good about it. Maybe he felt like it
was
worth it.
Yeah, I mean, if he had read it and just thought that I portrayed him all wrong,
right,
or, you know, I mean, it could have been bad. So
exactly.
I was really happy that he was at least trusted that I told his story responsibly.
Exactly. Okay, so since you are from Nebraska, what impact has this story made on you?
Well, I think it's just opened my eyes a little bit to how common some of these themes in small-town America can be. I mean, like I said, part of the reason I was attracted to telling this story in the first place is that the characters that I met in Royal, there were, you know, exact replicas of them in my own hometown. And what's been really encouraging since the book has come out is I've had people from small towns in Pennsylvania and New York and New Mexico and just all over the country saying, I don't know anything about Nebraska, but I recognize this character from the community I grew up in. And so people have, I think, latched on to sort of the universality of some of the themes in this book.
Right. So you've mentioned themes a couple of times since we've started talking. Can you tell me a couple of the themes that you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, the ones that pop to mind, I think, most immediately are obsession. You know, Dick Haskin, who started the zoo, certainly fell into a very deep rabbit hole of, you know, great apes. And, I mean, he followed that to an almost absurd degree. And so he really grew obsessed with getting this whole venture off the ground. And then isolation is another one. You know, a town of 81 people, that's a very tight-knit social community. And I think you start to see people spending their time and effort in very creative ways, you start to see things like pride and power kind of corrupt themselves a little bit.
So have you ever been to the zoo?
No, the zoo closed in 2005, not long after the chimps escaped and three of the four of them were shot and killed. And so I didn't stumble upon the story until 2009.
Oh,
and of
okay.
course, that was a big challenge in doing all this research
right.
and reporting, is that everything I put in the book had to come from
somebody
interviews
else.
With other people or newspaper research or just gathering all that information.
That makes sense. That makes sense. How do you feel this story serves as a representation of politics on a larger realm?
Yeah, well, one thing that I've sort of been repeating over the last couple of days as I do a book tour for this is just people use this phrase, small town politics, but it really just seems to me like politics. You know, I can't tease apart what makes small town politics any different than what we see in Washington, D.C. or New York or anywhere else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We in Royal and the board of directors at this little small town zoo, you still saw the same selfishness and greed and pride corrupting itself and just all these things that kind of tear people apart.
Right. So you kind of already touched base with this, but I just wanted to reframe this question a little bit. So this story demonstrates a lot of power struggle conflicts. What do you believe to be the root of this issue?
Well, I think it goes back to that isolation that I was
right.
talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a town like Royal, where the biggest attraction it ever had was this zoo, people started to connect their own identity to the attraction in town, right? And so then everybody wanted a part of this zoo. Everybody took a lot of sort of personal ownership stake in the zoo, and that's when you started to see things kind of unravel, you know, is when people tried to base their identity off what the community itself had bolstered.
So the title of your book is Zoo Nebraska, The Dismantling of the American Dream. Can you tell our audience who have not read the book why you chose this title and how it summarizes the entire story?
Yeah, well, both of them, I think, have kind of double meanings. Zoo Nebraska was actually the name of the zoo in Royal during the last chapter of its life. But I also liked the double meaning of thinking, I mean, Royal itself socially turned fairly chaotic when the zoo was crumbling apart. You know, there was a lot of gossip in town, a lot of infighting, and so I liked the double meaning there of the word zoo. But the dismantling of an American dream, that comes from me realizing at a certain point in my research that although Dick's dream was novel to him in terms of trying to pursue study of great apes, it's a much more common version of the American dream in that he was somebody who had a big dream, aimed for it, and fell a little short. You know, in America, we seem to tell this rags to riches story, but that so rarely comes true. More often are people trying their best, falling a little short, and, you know, trying to deal with those consequences.
Exactly. So how do you feel as a journalist, being able to have the voice to tell significant stories in history like this?
I love it. I think that's why I continue to be a journalist, and that's why, you know, I think a lot of the best journalists I know, we're not out here doing it for money. We're doing it because there's a certain freedom and a real joy that we get out of telling these stories that otherwise wouldn't be told. You know, I felt like I was breaking new ground by being the first person to tell the full story and the full saga of Zoo Nebraska. I mean, I like knowing that I've contributed even a tiny little bit to the way we look at this history.
Mm-hmm. So you said you started this book when you were 20, correct?
Yeah, 20 or 21, I think. It was the summer of 2009, and I was a senior in college.
I was going to say, so you've always been a journalist.
Yeah, I was in the journalism school at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and then I studied creative nonfiction writing in my master's program in North Carolina, and then I've been freelance writing as a journalist ever since then.
Very interesting. So as a journalist, you enjoy your job?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting time to be a journalist, for sure.
I'm
not sure that nationally we're getting a lot of respect right now,
right.
but I mean, there's always a need for good journalists, and I'm out here trying my best. So.
And you're doing very well at it, too.
Well, thank you very much.
How would you describe a good journalist?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on what kind of journalist you're trying to be. I think personally that I would not be a great daily news journalist because I'm horrible with really tight deadlines like that, but I'm so glad there are writers who can do that. I've always been the writer who needs to sit down with my subject and learn their entire life story and all their motivations before I can feel good about writing any of it. You know, again, one of the reasons it took me so long to write this book is because I felt the weight and responsibility of portraying these people correctly in a long-form format, and doing that required me to just spend a lot of time with them, get familiar with them, and really understand where they were coming from.
Exactly. And I think that's...
I think empathy...
Right. That's a very important part of being a journalist, is telling the story accurately. So I would definitely agree with
you. Absolutely.
What do you hope people gain from reading this book?
Well, I mean, like I said earlier, I hope that they recognize some of these characters from their own lives, you know, either the towns they grew up in or the towns they're living in now. And I also hope they look at this and say, oh, well, I serve on a nonprofit board, or I work with a group, and it's really doing nobody any good if we're all out to win it for ourselves. You know, I think a big part of the problem in Royal Nebraska and the zoo falling apart is because everybody had their own motivations, and they were all trying to achieve different goals with it instead of, you know, trying to come together and rally around one single great thing.
Right. What other stories do you hope to tell the world through your writing?
Well, I mean, I'm a freelancer, so I have multiple stories this week, you know, but the next, I think, book that I'm interested in writing, strangely, the world of cowboy poetry, which is a very niche little genre, but I followed my second cousin, who was a cowboy poet, to the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada, in February 2016 to write a story for The New Yorker, and I expected to just go there and fly home and write a quick story, but I found just a million fascinating characters there, and the genre itself has a really unique history. And so at this point, I've written 9 or 10 stories on cowboy poetry, and I'm hoping that maybe I can take all that material and shape it into book number 2.
That is super interesting, and I'm really excited for that to come out, because I'll definitely be reading it.
Oh, thank you, Taylor.
Of course, of course. Okay, so last question here as we wrap up. Where can people find you and your future work?
Absolutely. They can go to my website at carsonvaughn.com. They can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just at Carson Vaughn, or on Facebook at author Carson Vaughn.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Carson. I really appreciated this interview.
That was Taylor Milliner in conversation with Carson Vaughn. Again, carsonvaughn.com for more. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. Up in just over a minute, conversation with Ani DeFranco about her new memoir called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Rounding out the program tonight, I'll be speaking with Ani DeFranco. She has a new memoir out called No Walls and the Recurring Dream.
I'm holding here a book, not above but not the greatest, stolen for me by the latest in a long line of thieves.
We are going to be focusing, of course, primarily on the book. I'm going to be hitting music so little. The book itself, a first-person narrative. So I'm very curious, first off, if this was from a series of diary entries or sitting in solace and thinking back. Were you dictating to somebody while they just wrote down your memories? I'm looking at process on this point.
Yeah. Very solitary process for me, this writing of a memoir. A lot of just going inward. I thought at the onset that I was going to call up everybody I know and ask them to remember for me and help me get back to there and there and there. But that is not what happened. I just started walking myself back. And it was, just the process of remembering to begin with was challenging. But, you know, I'm somebody who didn't remember anything any more than the next guy. You know, we all have this feeling like, I have no idea. All of my friends said I could never write a memoir. I don't remember anything. And the same was true of me. But I can say now that if you sit there long enough and you stare into this space, things begin to appear.
That's a beautiful way of putting that. So were you then the final editor, despite whoever else's names may appear? Was it ever turned over to somebody else, I should ask?
Yeah, I did have an official editor there at Viking, and his greatest gift that he gave me was just, I mean, first of all, to leave me completely alone for a year, you know, and then he sent me, you know, the second email. The first was sort of meeting and here's my email. And then a year later, hey, how you doing? You know? And when I sent him earlier versions of the manuscript, most of what he said back was, keep going. This is great. I respect your voice. We checked in a little bit about, you know, how much do you want me to put the commas in the right place and the spell, you know, to
right.
sort of bring it back into the King's English. And we sort of played around with that balance point a little bit. But mostly he was my champion during the process, and I needed it because I wasn't sure I could do it. I wasn't sure what I was doing was good. Then beyond him, I let about, I don't know, 20 different people in to be people who volunteered to be my early readers. And their feedback was something that was very diverse in nature. Each person sort of said different stuff, and I navigated my way through all of that.
All right. Was it your notion to put out a memoir, or did somebody approach you with the idea? Who came to who, I guess, on this?
It was my idea. I had had the idea floating around for decades, really. The earlier iteration of the idea was sort of part handbook for being an independent musician and part, you know, remembrances. Anyway, that ship sailed a long time ago, and, and it's sort of the idea came back up more recently. For me, mostly, well, a twofold strategy, really. One was just to have a writing challenge after hundreds of songs, you
sure.
know, put myself back into a place of being new, you know, do something for the first time. And another was just trying to figure out ways that I could work from home, quite honestly, because I have kids. Being a touring musician is real hard on the family systems, you know.
And it's nice that you do include some poetry and songs in whatever form one might call them within the book. So we have to wait until the end of the book, I mean, almost the absolute end, to get the recurring dream portion of the title of your book, No Walls and the Recurring Dream. Does it call for a spoiler alert if I want to give away the last line or two from the book? The reason for this is that people will read what you've gone through and mishaps and mayhem and whatnot and getting through your life. But you're talking about this collective search for joy. But you start with being on the stage with just the ghost light. Can you talk about this chapter for us?
Yeah, the way the book draws to a close is just with this literal moment of me crossing a stage, which I have done so many nights in the wee hours after the audience is gone and the theater is dark and empty. I play a lot of these sort of vaudeville-era old theaters in my touring. And so, you know, there's a tradition in these old theaters to put out a ghost light. It's a bare light bulb in center stage that they plug in overnight and they put out on the empty stage to keep away the evil spirits in the theater. And so this is a very evocative image for me. And, you know, at the end, yeah, just, you know, these are sort of existential moments for me, being alone and yet so accompanied, having this repeated, that sort of quantum query of, is this a recurring dream, or is this my life, or is it, you know, both? Is this nice. Not all a dream of our own devising, you know?
Sure. Wow. Well, then, as we go through these dreams, I wonder, I mean, you most certainly did not try to go in absolute order, or did you? I'm curious about, you know, when it came time to write things down, whether it was in the iteration of the guidebook that it was going to be, or the memoir that it became. You know, you certainly didn't start off with the high school years and the no walls, how you grew up and where you grew up. Or were these the first things that you tried to tackle? Did you actually try to go in order?
There's a vague chronology. I mean, it's not precise, you know, because
sure.
that didn't work out all the time. And I couldn't get to precision in my memory. But I don't think, you know, and I wasn't too concerned with those kind of details when I was telling the story. You know, I cite my great friend and mentor, this wonderful poet, Sekou Sundiata, who I crossed paths with in New York in the early 90s, and he had a phrase he would say and bring into his classes that, you know, in poetry, the important thing is to ignore the facts and tell the truth.
Hmm.
You know, so I employed a little bit of that in my chronology and my writing, but, you know, just trying to tell the truth in a way that still is a work of art.
Well, this truth that's come out in your music, I mean, just over the years, it has connected with so many people in so many ways. And that's one of the wonderful things, that what you do write about does connect. And we'll come back to that in a format a little bit later. But early in the book, I want to mention that as people go through the book and hear about the various things that you do, they have to really realize that you were only around 16 when you were truly on your own. And so I want to quote something. This is regarding your parents and you not necessarily being around the house very much. You could do anything you wanted as long as you'd continue to require nothing of them. Was this a literal statement or a figurative feeling?
Kind of both, maybe. My parents struggled in their relationship, in their marriage. My older brother struggled in that atmosphere of strife that permeated our family home. I just removed myself, and I went to seek happiness further and further afield. So, you know, because, you know, my brother was sort of taken down by the trouble in our family home, and I just refused to, you know, so I became more and more independent as a mechanism for transcending it, I guess.
Something that I would like to address also, and that is because it applies so much today. This comes from the entry called Martin Luther. And by the way, I struggle between calling these chapters or entries because they just feel it, you know. But the entry called Martin Luther, I really appreciated the titling of that one, in that he's not even mentioned, but there was a quite literal posting of a declaration on the door.
Yeah.
If you could explore this, the victims of their own liberation, such a powerful statement there. And we're speaking about your mom there.
Yeah. My mother was the first female in the architecture department at MIT. You know, she was a feminist who, you know, entered an all-male world. You know, this is in the 60s, late 60s and 70s. She was a professional architect, you know, a brave and driven woman. But, you know, this is also an age, you know, my father was 10 years her senior, you know, and sort of old world. Here's an Italian, comes from an Italian immigrant family. So, you know, the conception was still that the woman, the mother, is the nurturer, is the house cleaner, is the cook, is the laundry doer. You know, so here was my mother carrying just this inhuman load. It made her angrier and angrier because it was just unsustainable. And so at some point, I think I was 9, I came home. You know, I was a latchkey kid. Both my parents worked. And I come home and I stick my key in the door. And there's a declaration, as you say, stuck to the glass on the front door. And it remained there for years and years as it faded. The words faded in the weather. But the declaration began, "These premises are no longer under the supervision of the housewife system." And she went on to detail all the things she was no longer going to do all by herself. And it was on us, you know, my father, my brother, myself. Yeah, she quit.
Yep. We spoke of you being away from the house, and for many good reasons, as a person reads through the book. I don't want to paint a picture of a kid who just ran away from home. But what I want to point out, though, and it's so important to realize that how on your own you were, yet you were still maintaining an incredibly responsible course. I mean, you ditched school as much as you could, but you were on your path to singing and performing, yet still making sure that you got either a high school degree or the GED. You ended up with that advanced track. That was interesting for a young girl at this point to be able to even propose to their guidance counselor or principal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't, like you say, I didn't really run away from home. Home ran away from me. You know, the home just dissolved under my feet, and I did what I needed to do. I was on my own when I was a teenager. I finished high school at 16 because I sort of came up with an accelerated program for myself in order to, you know, high school took a lot of time from a person who was supporting themselves and living on their own. So it was just not the kind of time I had, let alone, you know, I was already playing music and writing songs and getting gigs. And so I needed my time. But then I did continue to try to educate myself because I love it. I love, you know, especially when I was self-directed as a 16-year-old starting to take classes at Buffalo State College first and then at the New School for Social Research in New York, I just because I was on my own and supporting myself and working at a young age, I was aware that sitting around with people talking about ideas is a luxury, you know, is a privilege, and I so enjoyed it. There were so many things I wanted to learn, so many things I wanted to explore. So, yeah, you know, I enrolled myself. I got my student loans, and I took some college courses. I never went all the way to a degree because, once again, the music and now what was becoming the beginning glimmerings of touring for me started to take me away more and more.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Ani DeFranco about her new memoir. It's called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. More at RighteousBabe.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I would like to hear about some of the experiences, whether they're right around this time through college in that first apartment, or whether it's just on the road much later on, being introduced to the woman that showed you what it was like to be, a promoter and trying to get you gigs around town, some of the experiences which led to the need to put it into a book, or the ones that, you know, it's like this has got to be told. Close to the end of the book, you do speak of our life as a series of accomplishments. I would just butcher it if I tried to quote you on that. what were some of the things that came forward that made you know that this had to be told?
Yeah, I think that moment that you're remembering from the book is, I think I sort of try to describe the path of my own liberation as that each accomplishment elicits the next. It's really just about pointing yourself in the direction of becoming, for the momentum to take hold. And then I sort of go on to say that it's not even the accomplishments in the end, the achieving of these goals, but the relationships that you forge along the way that have meaning. And one idea that came up early on, like before I started writing this book, was I had the idea to include a series of letters of thanks to my mentors, my teachers, the people who made me. And a few publishers that I met with picked up on that idea and said, oh, cool, you should do that. And I feel that in the end, that's what the whole book is. I made the need for a series of letters redundant by just framing my whole story that way, which is sort of how I see it.
Nice. Just a little bit around writing songs, but something that shifted your songwriting, and I want to say poetry put to music, that's songwriting right there, but not necessarily with those who write songs. Mm. But at one point, you got exposed to jazz. You mentioned that Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis shifted your sense of things, and Betty Carter changed the way you sing. So, first of all, Monk and Miles, was this your world all around, or was this specifically your world in the sense of putting together music that can go out there onto a CD or your mixtape or whatever?
I mean, it was just my deepest soul and spirit, I think, that when I grew the kind of ears, had the kind of experience on the planet where I could take in the expressions of these men who had had very different life experiences than mine, who came from a different era and place. But, you know, Monk and Miles, just so bold, so brave, so I don't care how it's supposed to be done, I'm doing it this way.
Yeah.
I just felt them so strongly. I mean, it's funny, they're very different, but they both kind of really inspired me in that wordless way that people can when they pick up an instrument and they express something very fundamental about humanity and our possibilities, you know. And then just literally their sense of timing, of harmony, of melody, you know, these things made a strong and sort of groundbreaking impression on me who had lived, you know, in the world of folk and roots and popular music up till then. And then, you know, by the time the world of jazz opened itself up before me, I was like, wow, beginning again.
Yep. So Betty Carter then, as far as there's so many wonderful jazz vocalists or vocalists out there, what was it about Betty?
It's hard to say, you know.
Okay.
I mean,
okay,
there's just something about what she communicated in her singing, the spirit that she brought through her voice that I, once again, just relate to. I don't know why her singing drew me in so much. It just did. And I think I have been able to discern its effect on my own singing. But, you know, of course, the world of music critics, unless I state these things, would probably never know or intuit her influence on me.
Most certainly. One of your entries, making songs, maybe number three perhaps. I almost avoided asking you about this, but still, I have to. I want to talk about the, not your apropos songwriting, what is this about? Because I know that many songs are not about some specific moment per se.
Mm-hmm.
But some of your songs are quite literally you. Others are about a situation which could apply to many, many, and so many people have this connection. So now to quote you just a bit, that your songs are never really being about this or that, but rather they're more about the hidden dynamic between this and that. Can you expand on that statement? I do know I am asking.
I tried a little in the book. Just, I think that, typical chick, I'm focused on relationship, I think that is sort of something that women specialize in, not certainly something that only women do, but I think it is our feminine side in each of us that prioritizes relationship. And so that is sort of where I have been transfixed, with the dynamics between entities. Social dynamics within society, power dynamics within people, relationships, groups of people, the dynamic of myself and the world, trying to make a place for myself within the world that I was given. So, I think that my songs have been similarly focused.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the other chapters or entries, if one will, my other voice. My wife works in the world of the other, by the way, and she is an other herself, and she'd be proud to hear me say that. You say, I discovered the voice in my guitar when I was a kid, but I would be a grown woman before I would really find the voice in my own body. I wonder how many songs are in retrospect. I mean, you write them and then pretty much move on, okay? And I know you don't you don't listen to your own music. I read that somewhere. But is there ever any type of a re-examination of your earlier work and thinking, well, I didn't have the same wisdom that I could have had when I made this earlier entry?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Evidence everywhere of evolution, and on the negative or more self-defeating side, just embarrassment, at expressions past. I talk about the first time I wrote about an abortion. I think I was 18. I had my first of two abortions at 18. And writing about it was difficult. I needed other women to step up and show me that it was possible. Lucille Clifton, a poet from Buffalo as well, she did that for me and helped unlock my voice around that experience. But that first attempt to write about it, I look back at it now, at that song called Lost Woman Song, and my voice is so clouded with the voices and judgments and framing of people outside of myself, But I had to start. I had to try to express my own experience in my own authentic voice. Of course, it's a process for many of us who come from the sidelines in various ways to find your own authentic voice, because we are so influenced and even burdened by the status quo, And in fact, at the age of, in my late 40s, I sit down to work on this memoir, and now I'm writing about these abortions once again, and in this time much more explicitly, in detail, literally. And luckily, during the process of writing, I encountered a book called Life's Work by Dr. Willie Parker. And he is an abortion provider that came to his work through a very interesting path. First, a man of the church who, when he went into medicine and then gynecology, refused to provide abortions because of his religion, and then had a journey of transformation by listening to women, by tuning into his patients and really what was happening and what was needed and what was life-affirming and what was the oppression, silencing, and nullification of women's lives in enforced reproduction. So anyway, this book by Dr. Willie Parker, in a crucial moment when I was sitting down to write my own book, he actually helped me shed these last vestiges of an outside outsider's perspective on my own truth and experience of the matter. So I'm incredibly grateful to him for stepping in and amazed at myself that even in my mid-40s, I can still be trying to uncover who I really am within the status quo.
Ani, there's so much we weren't able to get to. You have a relationship with Pete Seeger as far as in the world of entertainment, and it had to have been influenced, so we don't have time for that. Two things to address quickly, and one is just, I have to say, a funny moment. I'd like to hear about the birth of the logo for Righteous Babe Records, which is like the headshot you mentioned.
Yeah, it sort of graces the cover of the book. That moment, that photograph that I traced with a marker and turned into the Righteous Babe logo, and this sort of image that has followed me around ever since, which I didn't expect in that moment necessarily. Of course, the real moment was me on the roof of what was then the Righteous Babe Records offices in downtown Buffalo. So the backdrop was just the landscape of Buffalo behind me, but we replaced that with more surreal landscape, skyscape on the cover. But yeah, there's a moment which for me is dripping with irony because I'm never been comfortable in front of cameras, and so I'm trying to cope with a lack of confidence, with an embarrassment at being looked at and seen through this lens and everything that implies. And so I turn to humor often in life, and I just struck a muscle man pose, like, rah! You know, just because I didn't know how to just stand and face this camera. And that moment sort of has become representative of true empowerment, true self-possession, you know. So I love the kind of transformation of a coping mechanism into true empowerment.
Yes, a new Rosie the Riveter for, I guess, anybody who picks this up.
That starstruck girl is already someone I miss.
That was Ani DeFranco. Her new memoir, once again, is called No Walls and the Recurring Dream. More at righteousbabe.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks once again to Ani DeFranco. Thanks as well to Carson Vaughn and to Stephen Reichlin. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, Taylor Milliner, Sharina Wad, and KVCR General Manager Tony Papa. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR, it's composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So as always, thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.